for the day is United States v. Calvin Bender, Appeal 10-2652. All right, go ahead, Mr. Sanger.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Robert Sanger. I represent Calvin Bender. He is the defendant and appellant in this case. This case raises three, I think, very interesting questions, and I want to spend some time on the first two in particular, if I can, the third being the misdemeanor issue. The first issue is really very fascinating and involves the interpretation of 18 U.S.C. 666A2. And I think that the first thing that we have to start with is the fact that it is an ambiguous statute. And we know it's ambiguous because so many courts have tried to interpret it. We particularly have the interpretations of the Fourth Circuit in the Jennings case, and then we also have Justice Sotomayor's interpretation in the Gannon case. But I think we can actually go beyond that and make some sense out of this, because the code section attempts to set forth the basis for bribery for public officials who are state or local public officials involved in administering federal funds. And we have the parallels, 201B and 201C, which relate to federal officials. If we look at the language of 666A, it is very similar to 201B, which is bribery. It is dissimilar to 201C, which is gratuity. Now, the complication, and it's taken some time to think about this and try to work it out, why is everybody confused about it? Well, first of all, we have the Sun Diamond case from the United States Supreme Court. And in the Sun Diamond case, interpreting 201C, a gratuity, the United States Supreme Court says that there has to be something more than just an intention to build a reservoir of goodwill. So certain things can be given public officials who are involved in dealing with the issues that pertain to the person giving the gifts, and it may be just an effort to build goodwill. That's a defense to 201C.
Is that like giving a ticket to a football game or something?
Yes, and I think in the Sun Diamond case, it was Secretary of Agriculture Espy who was, in fact, given some tickets to a football game, among other things. It wasn't just tickets. I think it amounted to quite a lot of money, several thousand dollars. The point being that if we look at the statutory scheme for bribery of a federal officer, there are three parts to it. You can have bribery, which is a 15-year maximum sentence that requires a quid pro quo, that is an actual exchange of something for something very specific. You can have gratuity under 201C, which still requires a quid pro quo, but it doesn't have to be one-on-one. It's a more general quid pro quo. And you have the third category, which is a defense. It's not illegal, and that is to give gifts for the purpose of building a reservoir of goodwill. Now, if we look at that structure for a moment and come back to 666A, the statute here, which pertains to local officials, it doesn't make any sense. If we say that 666A covers all three categories, well, that can't be right, because certainly the third category is a defense. It's not, a person's not guilty if that's what they did. So does it cover the first two? Well, the language of 666A and 201B is in all respects identical to the extent that it matters here. Both involve corruptly giving something of value with the intent to influence an official act, in the case of 201B, with the intent under 666A to influence or reward an agent in connection with any business transaction or series of transactions. So it appears to be similar to 201B, in other words, to bribery.
Let's talk about that, Mr. Sanger, because, look, in the Sun Diamond case, Justice Scalia writes for the Supreme Court that, at least as I read this, look, for bribery, you need a quid pro quo. We'll talk about influence there. The key verb is influence. And for gratuity, we'll look at the verb or noun reward. Okay? If you want to go to 201, that might be B and C combined. And in the local official statute under which your client was convicted, 666A2, we've got with intent to influence or reward. Why isn't that sufficient to tell us that you can pursue either theory under A2?
Very good question, and that's that I think is part of the key to understanding this, is that the distinction that people got hung up on, and I say people, judges and probably lawyers in arguing the case, got hung up on, was whether or not a reward means something to reward prior conduct as well as future conduct. And that isn't really the distinction between these two. It appears in 201C that it is much more explicit that it can be either past or future conduct. And yet a bribe can be actually given for something that was agreed to have been done. If it was done, it can be given. So the actual temporal aspect of this is not controlling. I think the more important thing is if we're talking about the difference between a bribe and a gratuity, the important thing is whether or not it is a direct quid pro quo for one particular act or series of acts, which is what 666
or the
end. Isn't this properly viewed as just a quid pro quo?
I'm sorry?
Why couldn't this case be viewed as just a simple bribe, a quid pro quo?
Well,
if you vote on this... rezoning this area, and in exchange for that, I'll do all this work on your house.
Well, there's two issues there. The way it was pled, the indictment itself says that the defendant was indicted for exchanging something of value for a zoning change. It says for a change in zoning.
That's a quid pro quo.
Right. Change in zoning, but the proof in the case was not that it occurred at the time of the improvements to the alderman's house in 2004, in July and August of 2004, September perhaps, when the improvements were made to the house by Stanley Walchek, there was no change in zoning. So instead, the government said, "Well, look, the alderman was supportive publicly of the." Of the appellant's position that he should be able to develop this piece of property.
When did he vote against the whatever they call that industrial thing?
Oh, the PMD. The PMD, I believe, is a red herring, and there was never a formal proposal to make this a PMD. This area, they call it a corridor. There are small parts of it that were made PMDs. Now, PMD is like a zoning for industrial only, but we really mean it. It's harder to change that zoning. So the PMDs throughout the city of Chicago had been imposed sporadically in different areas. In this particular area, they talk about a corridor. A small percentage of this so-called corridor was a PMD. So it was not, at the time, an actual attempt. There was no motion before the city council or whatever it would take to make it a PMD. That was just a remark by the mayor when he was told of some resistance in the manner of the development here to, quote, PMD him. But there was never an effort to actually put forth a PMD and actually impose that on this particular piece of property.
Well, mentioning about him standing up against the mayor, I guess, is why I'm wondering about that. and when that happened, because, you know, this ongoing situation, if that was just a, didn't mean anything, it certainly would have meant something if it were imposed. So obviously, I don't know what the alderman had to do with stopping that or letting it be known he would not support it or something like that.
Well, I would concede that he let it be known.
That's enough, isn't it, in Chicago?
I don't know. Seemed to work here, right?
Well,
it's ironic, and I'm hoping to have a moment to talk about the other point at some point here, the attorney issue, because I think that's very important. But the point here is that the alderman always has something that they can offer. That's what they're there for. They're there to express their opinions about their particular locality, one of the 50.
And that's official action, right?
Mm. I don't know if it's official action if they're just talking.
Let me ask you, Mr. Sanger, how is the bribery versus gratuity, quid pro quo or not issue, how was that framed in the district court?
It was, there was a proposed jury instruction to have an instruction quoting the Sun Diamond language on building a reservoir of goodwill, which was refused, and then that was revisited, I believe, in the motion for new trial.
Okay.
If there are no further questions on this, may I talk about briefly about the attorney-client issue, because that I find troubling. And this is a case where Mr. Boonder went to the criminal defense lawyer on day one, which was February 25 of 2008. On February 26th, the lawyer did other business, didn't work on this case. February 27th,
Reedy?
Yes, I was not saying his name, but Mr. Reedy. Mr. Reedy then went into the U.S. Attorney's Office and talked to the two assistant United States attorneys who were involved in this matter, still in an investigative phase. And the question here played out in a way that we have argued was objectionable for a variety of technical reasons. But we have to look at the very beginning. What happened? Mr. Reedy did not preserve his client's confidences. He went to the U.S. Attorney's Office, made representations saying, quote, these are hypotheticals. Hypothetically, what if?
He was unauthorized when he did this?
He was, according to his testimony, he was authorized to go in and talk to the U.S. Attorney in the sense he said, I'm going to go do it, and told the client that. And so far, he's doing fine. He said, hypothetically, what if, in trying to understand this very complicated case on day two of his representation. He hasn't read the documents yet. There's boxes that went to an associate that weren't even looked at yet. In the course of that, he says, what if there was an invoice that was, and hypothetically, what if there was an invoice that showed that Mr. Boonder had actually sent an invoice to the councilman for the work on the house? In other words, what if that were the case? At that point, the assistant United States attorneys look at each other and decide that this is something that they don't believe happened because Mr. Walchek, their witness, had gotten immunity, and he had told them that one of the theories that he and Mr. Boonder had talked about was an invoice theory. Okay? So they immediately
had immunity at that point and was talking to... Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. He had immunity at that point. And he was already talking to him, and the U.S. attorneys knew this. The assistants knew this. So the AUSAs at that point told Mr. Reedy, well, if your client has an invoice, then that's false. And this is where it falls apart, because I respectfully submit that the lawyer at that point should have said, well, I'm talking to hypothetically. I've been on the case for a day. I need to go back and talk to my client, and I'll come back to you. He didn't present a document. He didn't offer the document to him. He didn't do anything. And there's a question as to whether or not he had the document. He said he had seen a copy of it, and Mr. O'Connor said that he called him up afterwards and said, I have to see the document. So who knows? But it doesn't really matter. The question is, The point is, at that point, what is a criminal defense lawyer do? And this is what's troublesome, because having been a criminal defense lawyer for 37 years, it goes right to the core of what we do. You get clients that come in all the time who are going to say things and ask things, and they're nervous, and their life's falling apart, and they're desperate. And one of the things you have to do as a lawyer, as I'm sure your honors are all well aware, is you have to counsel your clients. And one of the things you counsel them about is you can't do that. Don't do that. That's wrong. That's illegal. That's suborning perjury. That's obstructing justice, whatever it is. You tell them not to do it. You don't have
inspired. Once you finish the thought,
you don't have an obligation to, in fact, to the contrary, to go right to the government and turn over the document and say, and by the way, you haven't subpoenaed it, but I will accept a subpoena later for this document I'm turning over today, which makes the case for obstruction against your own client.
You making an ineffective assistance argument?
I can't hear well.
Ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, we raised the issue on several different levels as to how this came about, and that in part it was through the collaboration of the U.S. Attorney's Office, because they then said, well, look, how can we get this document? And 2 days later he says, well, I'll send it to you, but you agree to give me a subpoena. And then he agrees to turn over the typewriter that was typed on so that he could avoid having to testify. We go from there to the point where we have the other objections, where the judge then allows the U.S. attorneys in the room while Mr. Reedy is called in for essentially a pretrial deposition, and the whole thing falls apart. Mr. Reedy then testifies against the defendant, and that sinks his ship for the entire case.
Thank you, Mr. Sanger.
No further questions. Thank you very much.
All right. For the government, Ms. Kastanek.
May it please the Court, I'm Andriana Kastanek on behalf of the United States. At the outset, I'm going to address defendant's argument that the district court misinterpreted Title 18 U.S.C. 666A2. That statute unambiguously prohibits both bribes and gratuities. This conclusion flows from its plain language, which criminalizes a gift made to a public official with intent to either A, influence, or B, reward that official in connection with business or transaction exceeding $5,000. Those two words, influence and reward, represent separate prongs of that statute. The Supreme Court in Sundiamond interpreted the federal bribery statute, which applies to federal officials, 201B, and said that the term to influence connotes bribery, a quid pro quo or an exchange. And that same conclusion extends to 666A2. With respect to the second prong, which is reward, the Supreme Court in Sundiamond also addressed that, and it held that a reward and a gratuity are essentially synonymous. And I need to correct one mistake that the appellant made, which is that he argues that a gratuity is distinct from a reservoir of goodwill. He characterizes a reservoir of goodwill as legal conduct under 666A2, and that's not correct. In Sundiamond, the Supreme Court said that it defines a gratuity as essentially creating a reservoir of goodwill or somehow currying advantage with a public official or currying favor with that official. So as applied to 666A2, the term reward extends to gratuities.
So what was the basis for rejecting the proposed jury instruction?
That is correct, that on the legal ground, as a legal matter, the instruction that the defendant proposed in this case was incorrect on a number of different grounds. The defendant proposed in an instruction in this case that said it provided that you may consider the distinction between a bribe and a gratuity. To establish bribery or official conduct, the government must prove that Alderman Carruthers accepted payments for the performance of an act, knowing that the payments were illegal or knowing that they were intended to influence the performance of an official act. Now, this is wrong on a number of levels. The first is that it focused on Alderman Carruthers' intent when, in fact, the conviction, the indictment, was under 666 A2, which focuses on the payor's intent, in this case the defendant. It also was wrong on the level that it excluded gratuities. So the district court gave the jury an instruction that tracked the statutory language, and it encompassed both influence and reward. And that was correct. One more note about instructions in this case. It was asked of the appellant what the procedural posture below of this matter was, and he responded that it was raised in the context of jury instructions, and that is correct. But on appeal in his opening brief, he does not take issue with the instructions that were given. This was raised as a sufficiency of the evidence argument, and he raises the instructions issue for the first time on the reply. But for the reasons I've already gone through, that instruction was not an error as it was given to the jury here. In any event, the court need not even reach the legal issue of the interpretation of 666A2. The evidence in this case overwhelmingly establishes that the defendant gave Alderman Carruthers a bribe in connection with the rezoning of property he owned, which is Galewood Yards. This is demonstrated by a number of different pieces of evidence in the record. The first is the defendant's own statements. When he was approached by Nancy Kiernan, who used to be the special projects manager of, or special projects developer of the Planning and Development Commission, he told her he didn't need to deal with her in the context of the PMD, the Planned Manufacturing District, because he, quote, had a deal with the alderman. This very clearly demonstrates that in his mind, he viewed his exchanges with the alderman as a quid pro quo. And on this point, I'll correct another misstatement by the defendant, which is in connection with the PMD. He was asked whether there was ever a proposal for a PMD in the works, and he says, well, no, a proposal was never finalized. And the reason that it wasn't is that it was under consideration in 2004 by the City of Chicago's Commission of Planning and Development. They're responsible for planned manufacturing districts in the city. And there were three aldermen that were responsible for the land on which Galewood Yards was located. Alderman Carruthers was one of them, and he was the single alderman that opposed the planned manufacturing district. And the testimony at trial, including by Denise Casalino, who was the former manager of that commission, and Nancy Kiernan, established that the reason that the PMD never went forward, the reason it did not succeed, is because Alderman Carruthers spoke out against it. He attended meetings with the commission in which he stated that he was not in favor of, he wanted to rezone Galewood Yards to permit commercial and residential development, and that was inconsistent with the execution of a PMD in that area. With respect to the other evidence that indicates that there was a quid pro quo in this case, the defendant made a number of similar statements to the contractor that was doing work on the alderman's house, Stanley Walczak, that were consistent with what he told Nancy Kiernan. For example, he told her, or he told the contractor in connection with replacing some exterior doors, that he should go ahead and do the work because the guy is worth it. That's at page 123 of the supplemental appendix. And when discussing air conditioning units that were installed in Carruthers' home, the defendant told the contractor that Carruthers had helped him a great deal with changing the zoning for Galewood Yards. That's at page 119 of the supplemental appendix. This is further supported by the chronology of the events in this case, which show a pattern of activity by the defendant and reciprocal actions by the alderman. It started in June of 2004 with painting his house. In the beginning of July of 2004, the alderman went and met with the Commission of Planning and Development in July. Then he turned around and did additional repairs in the form of installing 31 gold trim windows at the alderman's house. And the alderman reciprocated by going and doing an interview with the Chicago Sun-Times. This all culminates eventually in the rezoning of Galewood Yards in 2006. But contrary to the defendant's argument, that's not a necessary element of violation of 666A2. That a bribe or a gratuity need not be successful, need not result in any action on the part of the official to be convicted of offering or paying a bribe or a gratuity. So although in this case it provides evidence of the payor's intent, that is not a requisite element of that statute.
Ms. Kostanek, I guess my question here for both sides really has to do with this procedural posture, and I'm trying to decide. I mean, it's an interesting question. Okay, how does one read this statute? But I'm trying to understand sort of procedurally and in terms of our standard of review, what's most relevant. I understand your position to be, look, the statute covers either theory, but even if you think it applies to, even if you think it requires the quid pro quo, the evidence permits that finding, and that's as specifically as the issue was raised in the district court, hence the government ought to win. Defense, I understood to be arguing, in essence, to be saying we were entitled to something more specific, more squarely putting that issue to the jury. Comment?
Sure. Let's take the defendant's two arguments separately, because as raised in the opening brief, it's really just a sufficiency of the evidence argument. He doesn't argue that the jury was somehow misinstructed on this point. And so with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence argument raised in the opening brief, the evidence certainly is sufficient to demonstrate a quid pro quo if that's necessary, but the plain text of the statute also encompasses gratuities. So that resolves that issue. With respect to the instructional error, which I believe that your question is asking about, there are a couple of different responses to that. The first is that the district court in this case used the pattern instruction from the Seventh Circuit to instruct the jury on the elements of 666. So even if there was error in terms of giving the jury an instruction, a definition of the terms reward or influence, if that's what you read the defendant's argument to be, any error in that regard was not plain or obvious because they were following this court's established precedent in that regard and the court's pattern instructions. It's also important to note that the evidence in this case doesn't really tee up the issue that the defendant is raising. This case is not on the outer bounds of what a bribe is. It falls squarely within the quid pro quo that is prohibited by the statute. So accordingly, in the closing arguments of the government, which is at pages 1413 through 1431 of the trial transcript, the government argued that there was an exchange between the alderman and the defendant, and it came in the form of home improvements and responses by the alderman in the form of supporting rezoning. So immediately before the jury got its instructions, it was told the theory of the case is an exchange, a quid pro quo. So even if there's ambiguity with respect to the word reward in the statute, that's just not presented by that case. Any error in terms of instructions would have been fully harmless.
Could you address the treatment of the attorney-client privilege issue?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, the defendant raises a series of challenges. I'll focus on what he discussed in his argument, unless there's any other questions regarding his actual challenges in the brief. He makes a number of arguments about the hypothetical attorney proffer and whether that was authorized. The only testimony that was at trial regarding this issue was that the attorney Reedy was authorized to go and meet with the government in order to put his client's case in the best light. And the district court made that finding, that that's the purpose of that attorney-client proffer. So to the extent that nothing improper happened at that meeting, but there's no reason to believe that that was not an authorized meeting. And in fact, after he left the meeting, the attorney left the meeting, he received authorization from the defendant to then, in turn, disclose the invoice to the government and to send an email to the government regarding whether that invoice was fabricated, and those are both in the government's appendix. There's no indication that there was he was asked in his argument about an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. There's no indication that there was ineffective assistance of counsel, but in any event, the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply pre-indictment, and that's what this was. It was a meeting between defense counsel and the government to discuss hypothetically the case prior to indictment. It's also important to note that at the time that this meeting occurred between the government and the defendant, that any crime of obstruction by the defendant would have been complete. The government knew at that point that he had created an invoice, and by the time the in-camera hearing happened, the government also had a number of pieces of evidence that indicated that invoice was fabricated. They had talked to his business partner, who said that when they were collecting documents in response to various subpoenas that had been issued to the defendant's company, that the defendant had said to his business partner, "I really wish we had invoiced the alderman back in 2004, indicating quite strongly that that is not what happened. The government, by the time the in-camera hearing happened, also had talked to the defendant's accountant, who had been responsible for creating invoices for all the defendant's company, and she had said she had never seen this invoice. So the defendant at this point had given... I'm sorry?
The contractor who had immunity.
Yes. What about...
You talked to him, too, apparently.
Yes, I believe. I was not part of those discussions, but I believe that they had talked to him at that point.
Well, yeah, but if he's got immunity and he's testifying that there wasn't any invoice...
Well, right, but what we know now, looking back at it, is that the defendant and the contractor had this midnight run to Starbucks, as the contractor testified at trial, in which the defendant and him talked about what story to tell the FBI. And at the defendant's request, that contractor told the government that they had invoiced the alderman. So what we find out later is that story is made up.
This is after immunity?
I don't know. I actually don't know when immunity was given in the case.
Okay.
Returning to the in-camera hearing and his various challenges about the attorney-client privilege, the decision to hold the adversarial hearing very briefly. The defendant argues that this was outside of the district court's discretion because Zolan prohibits the district court from doing such a thing. That is not actually what Zolan holds. It actually it says that actually an adversarial hearing in this context would be preferable to an in-camera hearing because it doesn't impose the same types of burdens on the district court, and that's consistent with this court's precedent in NADA as well as the third court's opinion in In Re Impounded, which addressed a similar hearing. So there was no abuse of discretion here, and the district court actually went to great lengths to consider the propriety of that type of hearing. If there are no further questions, we'll stand on our brief with regards to the remainder of the issues. And we ask that this court affirm the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kostanek. Let's see. Mr. Sanger, would you take a minute and a half in rebuttal? So.
Very quickly, to answer Judge Mannion's question, if I may, Mr. Walchek was given immunity, I believe, in November of 2007, but it was clearly before there was, and he was debriefed, before there was the discussion between the AUSAs and Mr. Reedy. Does that answer the question? And then with regard to the jury instructions, we did raise this in a brief. It's not as a separate headnote, but it's under the list of issues that we raised specifically on page 21 of the brief, towards the bottom, and we also indicated that it was raised in the motion for new trial. There were, and I'm going to say this, but I was trying to find it quickly, there were two proposed jury instructions, and counsel for the government referred to one of them. There was another one, I believe, that very specifically quoted the language about the reservoir of goodwill, and Sun Diamond does say that it all involves a reservoir of goodwill, and the question is it just a reservoir of goodwill? So that is a defense. I stand on that. I think that's a minute and a half. So
thank you, Mr. Sanger. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Case is taken under advisement. We'll proceed.